You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education Issue Review podcast for the edition covering the 15th to the 21st of October 2015. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by books editor Karen Shook, writer Matthew Rice, deputy news editor John Morgan, and rankings reporter Ellie Bothwell. The Higher Education Green Paper is on its way, and John Morgan has the inside track on what it might look like. That's the topic of this week's Splash, and he'll tell us more in a second. The first of six THE subject rankings is out now. It looks at courses in clinical, preclinical, and health disciplines, and Ellie will tell us a bit more about the other rankings to come, and indeed the winners and the losers in that clinical, preclinical, and health ranking too. And Karen will have her regular rundown of the week's books section, while Matthew has been talking philanthrocapitalism with Lindsay McGurry at the University of Essex. Is it Essex? Is that right? It is indeed. Good. We'll come to that at the end of the podcast. But first, John, HE Green Paper, TEF, all that malarkey. It's a busy time in politics. What have you been finding out?
So the Green Paper, which at one stage was expected this week but hasn't emerged, we know that it's going to be split into four key areas: the teaching excellence framework, widening participation, market entry and exit, and also reshaping the sector's regulatory framework. So in particular, I'm looking at two of those in my story this week. David Cameron, during the election campaign, set out quite a big target on widening participation, saying that the government wanted to double the proportion of disadvantaged young people entering HE from 13.6% in 2009 to 28% in 2020. Mm. It's not received a huge amount of attention. It was sort of buried at the end of a press release. But ministers, regard it as extremely important, and a surprise that it hasn't received more coverage. And indeed, Jo Johnson said at a fringe at the Conservative Party conference last week that one of the core metrics in the TEF is going to be around widening participation, about the progress and value add that universities offer to students from poorer backgrounds and their retention and completion rates. Mm. So I spoke to Nick Hillman, director of HEPI, and he suggested that this target that Cameron set, although it didn't get a lot of attention, actually this is a key driving factor in the TEF, because ministers have thought, goodness, we've got to do something to get to this target. We need to provide universities with some incentives. And the other aspect that I'm looking at in terms of the Green Paper this week is market entry and exit. Mm-hmm. So not only has Jo Johnson talked about the need to bring in more private providers to compete with universities, but at the fringe at the Conservative conference, he also talked about having the capacity for more rapid market share shifts between universities, and students quickly moving from one provider to another, and if they see that one is better quality than another, and if universities have to pull out of courses because they're not good enough, then needing to offer students protections if their course stops being offered, so they can be taught out. So the idea is to create a fully functioning market by creating the possibility for universities to leave the market. And spoken to quite a few experts who are saying that this is raising concerns about the value of UK degrees. We've always had this stability. You get a degree from university, that university will last forever. But this new market approach could create a world of fly-by-nights and undermine the UK's global standing.
Mm, interesting. And when can we see this Green Paper now? That I know there's the rumour mill is working overtime. Do we have any inclination when it might make its appearance?
Well, there was a very firm impression coming from Biz this week that it was going to be October the 15th. But the noises Jo Johnson has been making, he's sort of talked about weeks when he was speaking earlier this month. I got the impression that he would much rather prefer a longer timescale towards the end of this month. And I was at a conference this morning where someone from Biz was saying that there's no date been set for the Green Paper yet, and indeed they haven't even got a spot in the grid, the system that coordinates government announcements. So I think towards the end of this month is likely, but we're certainly not getting towards a firm date. There seems to be a difference of opinion within government about when it should be announced.
Nobody's booked it in, basically. There's no slots available.
No.
Good stuff. Well, of course, we will have the latest on those developments on timeshighereducation.com as and when they happen. Moving on, though, there is a rankings launch this week, and indeed every week for the next 6 weeks, looking at subject-specific tables. Ellie, you've been covering this.
Yes, that's right. So, there are six different subject rankings we publish. We've just released the clinical, preclinical and health discipline ranking. Mm-hmm. The others to come are arts and humanities, life sciences, social sciences, engineering and technology, and physical sciences. Mm-hmm. In the ranking out this week, it sort of really mirrors the trend seen in the overall world university rankings. Institutions in Europe are doing better, the US's dominance is waning. It's the same sort of story. Germany did very well in the World University Rankings and is doing very well in this sort of clinical table.
Mm. You say that, but I'm looking at the top 10 and it does still seem to be fairly United Kingdom, United States dominated.
Yes, that is true. It's sort of hard to shake off some of these sort of elite institutions. The top of the table is sort of as you might expect, but kind of when you get further down below the top 10 or the top 20, we're seeing sort of other countries emerging stronger. The UK sort of it hasn't done quite as well as it did last year, but there are some sort of standout institutions. So King's College London is one we've picked out, has done very well. It's entered the top 10 for the first time. Mm-hmm. And sort of speaking to some of the institutions that have done well, one of the things that they've cited as a reason for their success is collaboration. So sort of working not just with other universities but with industry, obviously in medicine, that's a sort of in particular that's a sort of key driver. Mm-hmm. We're yet to see whether we'll see the same trends in the next subject rankings.
Indeed, interesting. Well, those rankings come out each Wednesday at 5 p.m. The first one was out yesterday, and there will be five more in the coming 5 weeks. So do keep an eye on the ranking section of the THE website for the latest announcements there. Moving on to books, Karen, what's in store for readers of this week's book section?
Well, this week, Anne Carter from Nottingham Trent University looks at Raymond Coppinger and Mark Feinstein's book, How Dogs Work. It's all about behavioural shape, apparently, so... I think anyone who's thought of small, yappy type dogs and large, knock you over dogs may
how
think there's some wisdom in that.
How they function
and also working dogs.
So
a nice dual meaning there. Also, this week's book on Hitler and soft furnishings. If you ever wondered what Hitler's interior decoration aims were, the book Hitler at Home by Despina Stratigakos will tell you. Neil Greger reviewed that. This book looks at how Hitler was presented, the kinder, gentler, at-home, slippers-on side of the Führer. And indeed, there were campaigns at the time to make sure he was well presented in the press that cared about these kinds of things. So there were photo essays titled things like Hitler Away From It All and The Hitler Nobody Knows. And as was recently pointed out, the British magazine Homes and Gardens got stuck in as well and did a lovely photo essay of the dictator at home. Also this week, Jane Appleton reviews Kate Brown's book, Vulnerability and Young People, Care and Social Control in Policy and Practice. This looks at the increasing use of the term vulnerability in policy arenas such as child welfare and protection. And Kate Brown's argument is that this concept can work to marginalise young people. Interestingly, the people that the author looked at in her study who had complex disadvantages, many of them saw vulnerability as something that applies to other people and not to themselves. Also this week, Helen Fulton reviews the eminent historian Jacques Le Goff's final book, probably his final book as he passed away recently, Must We Divide History into Periods? For those of you who hated the, and now we're moving into the Renaissance, an eminent historian said, nope, no need for that. And our book of the week this week, Helga Nowotny, who for four years actually, was president of the European Research Council, has written a book called The Cunning of Uncertainty. Now, this takes on all manner of targets, the peer review system, which she says affords disproportionate credit to high impact factors, the awe of big data, she also trains her view on. Mostly, our reviewer Flora Samuel says, its key questions are things like, how good are we in educating young people for uncertainty while continuing to train them for certainty? So a policy overview, research, the very practice of scholarship, and Nowotny argues that maybe it's important to say more often than academics do, I don't know.
Excellent. Thank you, Karen. Click the books tab on our website for all of those reviews and more. The cover feature this week sees Jack Grove looking at academics and universities' efforts to address the ongoing refugee crisis, a very important feature and one that I strongly recommend you check out on page 30 and also on the site, of course. But Matthew, you authored our second feature this week and you've been interviewing Lindsay McGurry of the University of Essex.
Yes, well, she's carried out some research on this rather new phenomenon of what's known as philanthrocapitalism. I'm a bit like there are a lot of questions about, you know, whether it's a good or a bad thing for universities to become more like businesses. The same issues have been raised in the charitable sector and whether things that we all think are a good thing, like improving global health and so on. Should charities be making a profit, or should they be behaving in rather more traditional ways? And from this general issue, she focuses on the Gates Foundation, which is particularly a striking and prominent example. It now provides about 10% of the budget for the World Health Organization. And I think, you know, she says that most people of a sort of liberal-minded disposition rather like Bill Gates. Some of his fellow billionaires and their foundations have, you know, devoted a lot of energy to combating plans to combat climate change or public health care in America. There's even one who wants to try and abolish death. So, Bill Gates is normally considered on the side of the angels. And it looks at all the issues which surround his foundation, looking at both, the good things he's done and some of the criticism he's come in for, as this very significant phenomenon of charitable foundations getting more and more involved in things like healthcare and education, which were traditionally purview of the state.
Thank you, Matthew. Yes, indeed, very interesting stuff, and you can read more in a blog that you've written, I know, for us as well, on our blog section online. That's all we've got time for in this week's THE Issue Review podcast. If you want to comment on anything that we've discussed, or indeed anything in the magazine or on the website more generally, you can do so at Twitter, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, all the usual social media places, and of course at timeshighereducation.com. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.